As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Patty Barkley, Alison Rudd, and broadcasting from the Grey Northeast, Mr. George Culkin. Today we'll be discussing United's win over Manchester City, including that goal from one Wayne Rooney. And we'll also be debating an idea originally put forward by Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, which I think could improve international football. No surprises about where we start this week. Let's start with Wayne Rooney's overhead kick, or chilena, or bicycle kick, as you may know it. Patty, you've seen a few. You've written about them. I just wanted to ask you, just from a purely, I mean, we context and everything, with the winner, the Manchester Derby, that all makes it special. It was Rooney. But just in terms of how difficult is it to actually do what he did?
Well, obviously, it's very, very difficult if you use your shin, as much of the day two informed us last night. It was an incredibly, the more you think about it, the more you realize how risky it was, because, you know, the option of taking a touch and with your head and popping it in was there. The defender had fallen, had slipped. So it was incredibly risky, particularly to do in front of the City fans, but he probably didn't think about that. He probably thought it was the easiest way of popping the ball in the net. But in technical terms, it was perfect. But I think that you have to go...
Excuse me, I know you say it was perfect and then he shinned it.
Well, it doesn't really matter. If it goes in off your shin, it's... I mean, if it goes where it went at the speed and the trajectory, it was perfect. And who's to say, you know, he was bothered about whether it was the instep or the shin? I mean, Gascoigne, George will know this, Gascoigne would use all sorts of parts of his body instinctively to propel the ball in the way that his instincts told him it should go. I mean, it was remarkable. Where I don't think it was the greatest goal of all time, or even the greatest goal scored at Old Trafford by a Manchester United player this season, is that it wasn't complicated. I mean, Berbatov's was for me a better goal, a more artful goal, a more exciting goal.
It wasn't even the best goal scored at Old Trafford on Saturday. I mean, this is absolutely ludicrous, this debate. I thought Nani's goal was fantastic. Yeah. The way Giggs controlled the ball, his pass, Nani. Oh, that was sublime.
Glad you mentioned that and not David Silva's goal. The best goal. But actually, I want to ask you about that, Alison, because, I mean, you've played football. Strangely, on Saturday, I watched it on Sky, and I have no idea who the co-commentator was, because it wasn't the...
You never know anymore, do you?
Exactly. It wasn't the familiar Scottish voice we know and trust. Mm-hmm. And he's like, Rooney will never score a better goal than that, and blah, blah, blah.
It was also described as one of the great moments in sport.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is preposterous.
But your argument is that Nani's goal was better. Is it because what Rooney did isn't that difficult to do?
Well, it's not actually. It's not that difficult to do. The only thing you have to remember is when you decide, you have to decide you're going to do it. And I suppose to decide you're going to do it in a big match, in a big arena, is take some bottle.
You need to be pretty confident.
You need
about
to be
ability.
Cocky, and I think we can all safely say Rooney is cocky when you look at the way he celebrated the goal, which made me feel slightly nauseous, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, ridiculous.
It was. Really.
But all you have to remember is when you decide you're going to go for it, which I agree is it takes some bottle, as I say. Yeah. You have to remember to launch yourself with your non-kicking foot in the air first, and that requires some sort of mental dexterity to remember to do it properly. That's all, and that's all you have to do. And be aware that the ground shouldn't be concrete because you'll break a bone, you'll break your shoulder bone or something. If you've got to land on ground that's soft enough to take your fall. Once those two things are in place,
yeah.
It's not. It really isn't. I don't think it's as beautiful as Paddy said, a complex goal where a lot of teammates are involved,
yeah.
And there's a lot of intuitive one-touch passing, people have made runs, and everything comes together. So it's just one whole picture of beauty.
George, these people in the studio are clearly jaded professionals who've seen many great goals. Were you impressed?
Well, it's a conflagration of great timing, great technique, that instinctive split-second decision. I mean, I could decide to do something like that, but unfortunately I would break my neck if I tried it. I think the wider context, as you sort of said earlier, is that it's in this huge local derby. It's also a derby that's at the top of the league. So, I mean, you know, I think it was a fantastic moment. In terms of craft and teamsmanship and build-up play, I do think the Nani goal was better. But I mean, it was a wonderful finish. It was a sumptuous finish, and one of the very best you'll see of that type. I mean, I think, you know, it has to be placed into the context of where and how and when it happened, and that makes it fairly special.
But it is interesting that it is interesting that the hype has been there, and that as soon as it was scored, everyone decided to say it was the greatest thing they'd ever seen.
Ferguson joined in.
Ferguson's
seen more goals than all of us put together.
We're desperate for Rooney to be this star again. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
Stats lie and so on. This is his sixth goal of the season.
Yeah.
The pace he's on, this will be his worst year in terms of goals since 2003-04, when he was still at Everton. Mm-hmm. And he's not scoring and he's not playing particularly well. At what point, I mean, do we say this has just gone on too long? At what point do you maybe consider dropping Rooney instead of Berbatov, who seems to be the poor guy who kind of gets the shaft?
Well, it's interesting because I think Ferguson firmly believes that his moment's going to come, and if he just keeps persevering with him, it'll all click into place. Because there's no evidence to back up making him the favoured son, the favoured striker at all. I don't think. I don't mind at all if a striker isn't getting the goals if their work rate and the way United are set up, you know, they need some focal point for all that wonderful. I mean, they're a great attacking team, United. Well, it doesn't matter, and they're famous for their goals can come from anywhere. So I think it's unfair to judge a striker at United as long as if Rooney was getting involved and setting up the goals, but he doesn't. He was a liability for most of the derby match.
Yeah. Well, interesting point you say there, he's a liability. I'm just wondering if Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, even the great ones make mistakes sometimes, because when I look at this, I kind of feel like he gave City a little bit too much respect because he knew that Dzeko wasn't going to start. Mm-hmm. I mean, that everybody knew that. To go with Rooney up front on his own, you're at home to drop Berbatov, your leading scorer. That's a bit of a gamble, and I would argue is a gamble that didn't work out until Rooney, you know, pulled off that incredible overhead kick.
Mm-hmm. And probably explains
by which time Berbatov was on the pitch.
But he'd been on the pitch a minute. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, George, is this a case where, you know, hindsight being 2020, we could say Sir Alex actually got this wrong?
Well, did he? You know, Rooney scored that goal and they won. So,
he didn't play well.
But he didn't play. He didn't play well. But then he did. You know, he did what he's paid to do. And
no, United didn't play well.
No. Well, no, they didn't. They didn't. And as I say, you know, Berbatov was also sort of very heavily involved in Rooney's goal as well. And they, you know, they do look a better football team when he's playing, or at least they do this season, certainly. But you know, Ferguson sees Rooney in training every day. You know, he obviously sees 90% of him, in a working week, and must be hoping that that's the moment that sparks him off and gets him back to where he can be. But as you say, it's been a long time coming.
Paddy, if you're Berbatov, drop for the Arsenal game, drop for this huge game. I mean, Berbatov divides opinion. I am not a Berba fan. I don't think he's a particularly reliable or a pretty great player. But then, you know, I get people waving the statistics in my face and so on. And I'm glad that Sir Alex kind of thinks along the same line as me. I was kind of comforted when I saw him on the bench. But if you're Berbatov, you're in kind of an unusual situation, right? Because your contract is winding down.
Yep.
You make a huge amount of money. You cost a huge amount of money.
Yep.
Realistically, you know, you wonder about your future, like if you're not playing. I mean, when you're not going to leave, but
when you're over 30, when you're a heavy lad as he is, so you're not going to go on till you're not going to go on that much longer. I mean, what goes through his mind? I mean, America, Arab, you know, a big contract. I would have thought, you know, that he's got to be. A first pick at this stage in his career, and that'll be how he'll be thinking. I think he'll look to move in the summer, and I think he'd be crazy not to.
Where can he possibly move without taking a pay cut or moving someplace weird? Like,
it's difficult when you leave an English club. It's extremely difficult unless they're willing to pay you wages, which obviously wouldn't be the case in this instance. But I think Berbatov does have a decision to make this summer. Yeah, I think it's true. I think with the emergence of Chicharito, who's obviously going to be a very, very good player indeed, who's going to be a goal scorer plus, although mainly a goal scorer, he's going to be like a fit Michael Owen. He's going to score that many goals.
Like a theoretical Michael Owen.
He's going to be like Michael Owen in theory, yes. a practical version. A version that works, that has batteries. And he'll score as many goals for Mexico and Manchester United as Owen once did for England and Liverpool.
Maybe he'll win more with the national team level as well.
I think he's a better player than Michael Owen. Yes, definitely. Well, already.
One more word about City. Roberto Mancini came out afterwards and said that he thought that they played well and that they deserved more out of this game. Of course, they were without a guy like Nigel de Jong in midfield, who's very, very important to them. Mm-hmm. Alison, do you agree with the very handsome and very talented Bobby Mancini?
Well, as it's Valentine's Day, I'll say, yeah, they did deserve more on a romantic level. I mean, they were quite attacking and they were bold. And you always hope that if a side goes to Old Trafford and is brave, that they might get something more. Because it puts everyone else off, doesn't it? And hands them the blooming title.
Yeah. David Silva, who was arguably the best player on the field, missed the crucial chance of the game early on, where he could have put the stamp on it. City were wiping the floor with Manchester United in footballing terms. And there's the best, you know, as I say, arguably the best technician on the field, the craftiest man on the field, makes himself a position behind Evra, who was very vulnerable looking on Saturday, I thought. Unusually so. And should have scored, and that could have, they could have gone on from there to dominate the game, but they didn't. However, I still think this was Manchester City announcing themselves as a permanent presence in the top four. I think it was that good a performance on that bigger stage. It was a nerveless performance, a performance of a team that knew where they were going. Unfortunately, they didn't get there.
Sunderland and Spurs. Now, quick quiz for you, George. How many points have Sunderland dropped after being in the lead this season?
Well, it's 20, and I tweeted this from the match on Saturday, actually. Yeah, which is the highest.
I knew that. That's why I was asking about it. I thought it was statistic.
You're very naughty. You're very naughty. And that's the highest total in the Premier League this season, and it's, you know, ironically or whatever, it's the same total that Tottenham have gained from a losing position. So you could guess it was fairly inevitable what happened there. Yeah, very. I mean, from their perspective, Sunderland's perspective, very, very disappointing. Played very well in the first half again, but dipped off fairly badly, and it's something they need to address.
Sorry, go ahead, Alison.
No, I was just wondering whether or not, George, you think Bruce has given the team an excuse for that to happen, because when it goes wrong, he says, "Well, they're young, and this is what happens when you're immature." And he says, "I accept that's going to happen because I want a young team, so I accept they will sometimes not be able to hang on to a lead." So once you tell a team they've got an inbuilt excuse because you're young, then you're not going to overcome that problem.
Yeah,
are you?
And it doesn't actually work as an excuse anymore, because if you look at Saturday's team, now with, they've got a few injuries, obviously, and after the transfer window, they've got, you know, far more experience in there now. They've got Montari there, they've got Sessegnon there. They're not as young as they were at the start of the season.
Yeah, who's young on this team? I mean, apart from Henderson, I'm just looking at this. Bardsley was young when he was young, but that was probably a few years ago.
Well, we all were. We all were.
Welbeck. Welbeck's quite young.
Welbeck's injured. Cattermole's injured. Fraser Campbell's injured. Darren Bent's left.
Bent's 27. He's another one who was young for a long time.
Cattermole's middle-aged.
Yeah, but he's not there. You know, these guys.
Back up your point that they're not an exceptionally young team.
Well, he has fielded a very good team in the Premiership on several occasions this season.
I think for the first, Alisson's spot on. For the first half of the season, they were the youngest average-aged team in the Premier League. Yeah. But I can't imagine that they are anymore. But then again, it was one kind of one lapse in concentration, a fairly familiar one from for Titus Bramble over the years that cost them.
I mean, what position are Sunderland in the league, George?
They're seventh, and they've been sixth or seventh.
How do you spell Sunderland, where is it exactly?
I'm trying to make a point. Is that satisfactory or not?
Oh, it's beyond satisfactory, yeah.
Exactly. Why are we talking about this as if it's a problem? They're seventh in the league. They've got a young team, ergo they should tend to get better. I would have thought, never mind about, you know, when the goals come or what happens, pattern we can discern. Let's just say Sunderland are doing well.
Well, they are doing well, but I think having been sixth for such a long time, and, you know, in the context of Villa, Liverpool, Everton having disappointing seasons up to this point, I think they thought they had a chance of maybe finishing sixth, and I think that's the, you know, so yes, that's certainly they've certainly overachieved in terms of where they set out from at the start of this season, but they have got a chance, or they did have a chance to finish higher, and I think that's the sort of, you know, that's the disappointment.
I thought some of the football they played on the certainly on the highlights, obviously they would have picked the best of it, but it looked quite good stuff.
Played really well first half, and in Sessegnon, you were talking about David Silva before. They've got, you know, they've got another very small player, but can drift around about up front. Montari behind will give them an extra dimension. Mm-hmm. They just haven't got any options at all in attack or on the bench at the moment because of A, injuries, and B, having sold Bent, and they've now got a very tough run of fixtures. They play Everton, they play Arsenal, Liverpool, Man City. So they really need to get through that and get some players back and hopefully move forward before the end of the season.
George, just quickly on Sessegnon and Montari. When he signed them, did anybody ask Bruce about these players' personalities, and especially Sessegnon? Did that come up? And about whether they thought that, you know, for what seems to be a pretty close-knit team, you know, whether Sessegnon in particular might present an issue?
Well, yeah, we've, in passing, asked about it. Obviously, Sessegnon virtually went on strike in France, I believe, before coming over to England. So, that's something they'll have to deal with. I mean, they have got a tight-knit squad, but they've also got a few spiky characters in there. But, you know, the good news from their perspective is that Sessegnon was very, very keen to come. And obviously that has to be harnessed in the right way. And Montari has taken a 40% pay cut to come to Sunderland. So that says something about him and what he wants to do with a bit of luck.
I'm showing my own ignorance here. He's on loan, isn't he?
He is indeed, yeah.
So how
could
he have taken...
He's on loan with a view to a permanent transfer.
Spurs, I mean, it's getting to the point now. It's like one of those, like, you know, those like sort of clown cars where all the all the clowns get out, and like, you know, you wonder how they all fit in there. Van der Vaart, Gareth Bale, Modric, Huddleston, Yunus Kabul, the skipper, Ledley King, who of course has been injured forever.
And Woodgate, of course.
Well, Woodgate, now you're being funny, but although I think he was warmed up, didn't he, on the weekend?
He was on the bench,
yeah. I mean, how do they just keep going when all the good players are out and they're replaced by I guess, marginally less good but still effective players.
Well, that's, you've answered it, haven't you? They're still very good players.
They're still very good players. It's, I mean, Harry's, it's a mark of Harry's management, even at Portsmouth, where he couldn't afford it. He had plenty of good players.
Sorry. Now I'm going to go and have a right giggle. Did you say Harry couldn't afford it?
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
At Portsmouth?
I said Portsmouth couldn't afford it.
Oh, but Harry could afford it, because Harry bought all these players, and very good players.
Well, the club bought them, yeah, but yeah, Portsmouth couldn't. Harry made sure that Portsmouth had a lot of good players, even though they couldn't afford
them. Gotcha. I'm with you on that one.
We were just very briefly, we were talking about sort of character there earlier, but, you know, one thing that Harry said on Saturday, you know, what's the secret of the success of this thing we're talking about, players coming in, performing really well, and he said, no toe rags. He said, you know, there are plenty of great players in the world who you wouldn't touch with a barge pole because they're toe rags. I don't have any toe rags at Tottenham. And so it's, you know, it is that. And he mentioned people like Cranshaw. He mentioned, you know, people like Dawson who've had to fight to get into the team. When they're not in the team, they don't cause a fuss. They don't feign injury on a Friday. So they're saying they don't fancy travelling. And, you know, it's good players, but also decent characters too.
Alison, when all these guys are fit, is chemistry going to be a problem? I mean, getting them back into the lineup when all the supposed good guys are fit.
Well, that seems to be Harry's magic wand thing, doesn't it? He seems to be able to do it. I don't know quite how he does it, because George says, he says that he has no toe rags in his team, but, you know, he spent a whole season, it seemed to me, slagging off Pavlyuchenko for not trying hard enough in training, and yet every time he was forced to play him in a game, he looked absolutely world class and stunning. And yet Pavlyuchenko did not go in the transfer window when you think he should have, and he stayed, and he's still putting in a shift for the team. That is the magic of management. That is more important than deciding whether you're going to play 4-4-2 or two holding players or not. It's being able, how he does it, he juggles it somehow. And he's got lucky, because Cranshaw would have left Spurs if his wife hadn't been about to give birth, and he decided to stay put. So it's a mixture of people being in the right place at the wrong time for them, but right for Harry, I think.
Okay, so last week we had an international break, and as always happened, you know, because it was mostly friendlies being played, everybody was like, why do we have to have these friendlies, and the clubs aren't happy, and people pull out. The under-21 game, I think, was a joke. I think England had about 90 people pulling out. It seemed like everybody except for Jack Rodwell, were pulled out of that match. But this kind of got me thinking of an old plan, which I'd like to submit for your assessment. Karl-Heinz Rummenigge put it forward years ago, Adriano Galliani as well. It does suit the clubs in some ways, but the idea would be this. Basically, all the official international matches, so qualifying for the Euros and qualifying for the World Cup, you would play those. You would have an international season, as it were, and you would play those between, say, mid-May and the first week in July in odd-numbered years. So 2011, you would, in that space of 6-7 weeks, you would play the qualifiers, or the bulk of the qualifiers anyway, for next summer's European Championships and then 2013 for the World Cup and so on. And you would get rid of virtually all the international dates during the season. Now, you could make up for that. You could either start the season later, or obviously, or you could have a winter break, or, you know, you would have the games would be spread out, so players wouldn't be as tired at the end of the season. The clubs would obviously adore that idea, but I think it has a lot of merit because you would have those situations where a whole country would rally behind their national team, you know, during the international season. Maybe like the way it happens with the Six Nations in rugby, or indeed with the World Cup and European Championships themselves.
It's genius. You'd have a World Cup every year, don't you? Basically. You basically have a tournament every summer.
That's
basically the idea, yeah.
Well, yeah. That's genius, isn't it? Because we all love a tournament. Yep. We all hate friendlies.
Yes, I had no idea. I've been advocating this a tournament every summer throughout the world for a long, long time, and I had no idea until Alison said that I'd acquired somebody who agreed with me.
I think Doug Ellis probably invented the idea though, before Carl Heinz.
No, I think the problem, I mean, it's a good idea. It's an interesting idea. It's one that needs to be thought about. But I think that the key change is to separate international and club football in the same way as happens in cricket. Because until the players are employed, directly employed, by International Football Inc., because it would have to be done partly centrally because of the huge disparity between the wealth of the respective nations. Until the international footballers are employed by international football, there will always be club v country tension. And what I would like to see is this, and to pay for it, the abolition of the international friendly, virtually total, perhaps one a season, in order to open a stadium or to permit a country like England to play Brazil, which they obviously otherwise would not be able to do except in World Cups.
So you're kind of penalising, I mean, countries like Brazil or Argentina, yep. This is a huge source of income for them. And under the Barclay plan,
yes.
They would only get to play once a year in their friendlies, and the rest of the time would have to be stuck playing Peru and Venezuela.
Yes.
Colonialist?
Tough. But the point is, international football is dying on its feet. And it's dying on its feet mainly, not wholly, but mainly because of friendlies. The clubs don't like it, the employers don't like it, and I'm increasingly driven to the thought that they're every right not to like it. Because the matches are increasingly fake. I mean, England's game against Denmark in Copenhagen was an exercise. The players were acting, basically. One or two were playing. Milner, Eriksson were playing. But most of the players were doing fake pressing, you know, running up to someone, backing off that extra couple of yards early. You know, you've seen it in every testimonial match you've ever been to. It's still pulls a crowd, although it was noticeable that the crowd in Copenhagen was much, much smaller than it had been 5 years earlier for the corresponding fixture. But it just isn't football. And eventually, you know, people are going to twig.
You back the room in your hand.
I think it's a step in the right direction. But the main thing is for a World Cup every 2 years, a European Championship every 2 years, a Copa America every 2 years, an African Nations Cup every 2 years, and a properly integrated calendar. And what's more, there would also be pre-qualifying. I mean, I don't want to bore people with the detail of this, but during the World Cup, the countries... during the international tournaments, the countries that didn't qualify,
England,
would be playing.
94.
It might be England, it might be Montenegro, but they would be playing pre-qualifying,
right,
for the next round of qualifying matches. So it's certainly a move in the right direction. But the main thing is to make international football more lucrative by abolishing friendlies, and to separate it completely from club football.
I don't, honestly, Paddy, I like everything you're saying. It's, I don't get the equation, make it more lucrative by abolishing friendlies, because friendlies exist a lot of the time to generate income. So you'd be losing money.
Yes, but
money.
They generate a diminishing amount of income. England don't pack Wembley anymore, and the only reason they get anywhere near it is by offering, I mean, a lot of kids, the increasingly shrill voices you hear at Wembley are paying £5 or less for admission.
But under the Rummenigge plan, those games at Wembley would matter, wouldn't they, George? And you could have a whole international season.
But it's, all of that is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because as friendlies become more and more meaningless, so they're less worth watching, etc. I mean, something must be done in capital letters. How many times have we heard that about England and international football and friendlies? I do remember growing up and those friendly games were vitally important. The caps were great. Everyone wanted to play. Maybe I'm over romanticising a little bit, but that's certainly how it feels a couple of decades down the line. Mm. What about keeping all the international dates? This obviously won't happen, but just as an idea, keeping all the international dates before every qualifying match for whichever tournament, you have a friendly in the preceding week. So an international break goes from 1 week to 2 weeks, say, or 10 days, and the friendly that comes first becomes important, because it's the chance for the manager to pick either his strongest team or to experiment in a meaningful way.
What do you do with the Premier League, or what do you do with the league fixture? Or do you plan on 12 months here?
Well, we still have those dates now, don't we? We still have friendly dates, and we still have qualifying dates. I'm just saying, you put those two things together, so the break in between the domestic league is slightly longer. And when the manager picks a squad, that squad is the same for both right. games. So
sum up what you're saying, because I wasn't sure I get it. I just want to make sure I understand it. So basically what you're saying is we would effectively, if there's 10 breaks during the year and maybe 6 of them are for qualifiers and 4 of them are for friendlies, you would combine them in such a way, so we would basically only have maybe 5 breaks during the year, but they would be longer breaks, and there would always be a friendly followed then by the qualifying games or whatever official matches there are.
And I know there were double headers now, so there would maybe have to be 3 games. I mean, I don't know. This is just completely off the top of my head, but there's a way of making that friendly an important game, because it's the warm-up game before the friendly. So if the manager selects a squad, it's a squad that covers both games. If someone withdraws from that squad, they're withdrawing from the qualifying game. Qualifying game as well.
All that would mean is that you'd have players withdrawing from competitive games as well.
About this withdrawal thing, it's interesting, because the reason I come into this, we're inevitably we're in England, we talk about England, and we think of the Premier League and so on, but we look at it from the perspective of big countries with big leagues who do well internationally. But there's also a reality that, I was talking to a current Polish international last week, Irineusz Jelen, and he's like, you know what, screw this. Every opportunity to go back with my national team, I will take it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, especially people who don't play, you know, maybe it's a bit different for England internationals or German internationals or whatever else, but people who are from second-tier countries...
Yes.
I mean, they absolutely love this. I know the Brazilians and the Argentines, they would swim across to be able to get away from, you know, whatever godforsaken, you know, European hellhole they're in. And I don't care if it's Real Madrid or Barcelona. Messi always goes home. And they don't withdraw.
Yeah, that's true.
They do. You're
quite right. I mean, Swedes, for example, absolutely love being with each other. And in fact, this is a large part of the... of the explanation of why England are always, you know, underachieved. They don't actually like each other very much.
Really?
I like George. I like your plan, except that even if your plan came true, Capello would still pick Frank Lampard and not Scott Parker. Parker played really well in the friendly preceding the competitive game.
Time now for some quick hits. Arsenal roll over Wolves 2-0, and they look like the only side standing between United and a 19th league title. Yes, Alison, I know that hurts. 19th league title. They have a pretty big Champions League coming up this week against Barcelona. Paddy, what do you expect from the game?
Well, I expect to be a privilege to be there. I think it's, any chance to watch Barcelona is just mind-blowing. Any time chance to watch Arsenal is fairly mind-blowing to me. Obviously a lot of good passing. But I do expect Arsenal to defend very, very deep, to try to do what they tried to do in the last game, which they drew 2-2.
You may finish.
And that is to play very, very deep in their own half and keep possession for as long as possible.
I think playing deep for Arsenal would actually be a bit of a mistake, as you can read in my fine column.
It's a very fine column.
Exactly. Thank you. Blackburn hold Newcastle to a scoreless draw, but then, as Pardew said, there was enough excitement last week. George, is it just a case of accepting that with Leon Best, Shefki Kuchi, and Niall Ranger up front, you're only going to get so far? And should Newcastle just start thinking about next season?
Well, to take the second point first, no, that would be a bit of a mistake. 32 points, they should be fine, but they're only 5 points off the relegation zone. Yes, they'll only get so far with those players. Yes, they should start thinking about next season also. They've got £30 million in the bank as we speak, and they need to spend it wisely.
And of course, Ashley promised that every single one of those pounds will go towards strengthening the squad.
And they are actually in their bank. They've got £30 million down payment from Liverpool, which is fairly extraordinary.
After four straight wins, Liverpool dropped 2 points at home against Wigan. Alison, you're not worried, are you? And what do you make of Luis Suarez?
I think Suarez has actually started better than I anticipated. I mean, it can be all too easy in Holland, and I think it looks like he's adapted really quickly, so I'm very pleased with him. And no, I'm not worried. Sometimes you get a game where you play well, the opposition lift their game, and you don't quite get the win you need. We'll strive on. Liverpool will strive on and get into the Champions League places.
And Suarez, of course, hasn't bitten anybody yet.
Gab, one for you now. Ronaldo more or less announces his retirement. The Ronaldo, the one before Cristiano was invented, the one who top scored at a World Cup in 2002 and was undoubtedly a great player. It looks like he's going to pack it in Brazil. Assessment, please.
I think we're forever going to you're going to debate whether what matters more, longevity or brilliance over a short period of time. And for me, Ronaldo, for the period of time when he was great, was unlike anything else. And I'm talking about PSV Eindhoven, Barcelona, and the first year at Inter. The day he came back after being injured and re-injured himself was one of the saddest days I can remember. In a sporting sense. Fact of the matter is, he was part of the squad that won the World Cup in 94. He won the World Cup in 2002. And I think French fans, now that the statute of limitations is over, you all know that if he'd been fit and right in the head in 1998, there's a good chance he would have won that one too. A true gem, and he'll be missed. Now, as you all know, of course, the Times has a Facebook page with a special section devoted exclusively to the game, and our producer Chris is on there a lot, and you can ask us questions, and that's what Julian Barr did this week. Alison, this question's for you. After seeing more awful performance from Howard Webb this weekend and earlier this season, coupled with what he did in the World Cup, culminating in that awful final, where he really blew it. Is this going to affect the rest of his career and the way he's going to be viewed?
Well, I think Julian's being deliberately controversial. There was nothing wrong with Howard Webb's refereeing performance this weekend. Even Gerard Houllier agreed with the red card. Two-footed challenges, you get sent off.
I think Julian might be a Villa fan.
Well, his own manager agrees. But I think the bigger point that Julian might be making is that what tends to happen is a referee has his crowning moment in Howard Webb's case, because of a combination of factors, England not getting to the final included. He has the highest accolade. He referees a World Cup final, and through no fault of his own, it's a very poor final with a lot of discipline issues, and he is under huge pressure to not allow this spectacle to degenerate into a 9-10 sort of debacle. He does his very best, and a lot of people have come out of that thinking that Howard Webb now has a reputation for someone who bottles it, who isn't quite the referee we all thought he was. So there are two things going on on here. One is that Howard Webb has reached the peak of his career because he's not going to referee another World Cup final. And so every time he steps out onto the field of play, he's sort of, I think, in some people's eyes, seen as a referee who's on the downward curve. And that's unfair. He's still a very authoritative, highly respected amongst the players and his peers. He remains a good referee. And the World Cup final was not a debacle from his point of view.
That's all we've got time for today, but you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all your news, your gossip, your analysis, and also our web chats. Mine is on Mondays, and this week, unusually, Paddy Barclay and Ollie Kay will be doing some swapping round. Will you, Paddy?
It's to make it more exciting. I'm going to Wednesday for this one week only, and Ollie will be there on Tuesday.
It's the kind of thing we all need to do to spice up our web chatting lives. And of course, because today's Valentine's Day, I need to take this opportunity to wish everybody named Valentino a wonderful, wonderful Valentine's Day. Starting with you, Valentino Rossi, whose autobiography I once translated years ago. Join us next week. Till then, take care. Goodbye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.